to the Investigator's Report, an in-depth look at some of the world's greatest mysteries and topics of interest. So for the next hour, we ask you to sit back, relax, and fasten your seatbelts as we explore and detail areas in our history, ancient history, biblical history, world religion and philosophy, and unexplained phenomena.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Gary Purefoy once again with another session of the Investigator's Report. And as always, we are extremely glad to have you with us. And we are also extremely, count that two times, to have our return guest of Mr. Michael Tesserian. Michael, how are you?
Fine, Gary. It's nice to be on. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, now, it's been a little bit while since our first show, but we kind of got an idea of what we wanted to talk about specifically in this particular program, and that would be starting with the origins of evil. So I'm going to yield the floor to you and let you take it away.
Well, that's right. It's a fascinating subject. There's no doubt about that. It has been something that I've looked into a lot and found that there isn't that many years. We look at official religion or explanation. It just doesn't sync up, you know. Disembodied God is fighting some disembodied devil in hell, and that this is how it happened, that some naked progenitors of our Garden of Eden, you know, just trespass on some unknown rules of engagement and being innocent and naive. How could they even be penalized for that? This was something that just didn't make any sense to me whatsoever, you know. And nor has really any of the psychologists or the behaviorists offered sufficient explanations for this phenomena. Again, they tend to look at its nature's flaw in her highest creation. And of course, if we believe that, we believe that nature must be inherently flawed then, which is kind of ridiculous to believe that, because everything else except mankind is in perfect harmony, from the smallest cells to the quanta level, you see, to the greatest stars. Everything is in its orbit. Everything is connected. Everything has its rhythms and its pattern. And as we learn more about quantum science, as we learn more about holographic theory, we learn that even what we thought was chaotic or based in chaos is in fact part of a greater order still. So how then can nature, which has somehow come into being, make such a deficit, with a deficit in our highest creation, man. So again, basically, it was just that this didn't seem to answer anything for me, and I wouldn't just blithely accept the illogical and reason-subverting answers that were given to me by, officialdom, which of course starts in school. It starts in the assembly hall. It starts in religious education, and they explain all of this. And most people aren't even listening anyway, so it really doesn't matter. But I don't know, maybe it was because I grew up in Ireland, or in Belfast during the days when it was very, very violent there. And there just was an entire, wall-to-wall culture of violence on top of the normal working class syndromes that you've got. The banes of any type of working class area, which of course you have all over the world, but specifically in Glasgow, Manchester, Liverpool, Belfast of those days, it was pretty rotten. It was pretty grimy. And it was pretty rotten. And then added to that this wave of terrorism and just violence, and also a great deal of racism, an incredible amount of, prejudice. All of these things, maybe it was that culture that made me question more than somebody else would, what on earth is going on? Why is man so capable of all of this injustice and inhumanity? This was the important thing for me.
With that said, was... in comparison to the United States, because it would seem that perhaps maybe a lot of these issues over in Ireland were more so magnified a lot earlier, whereas now, how would you say the country has evolved to this point?
I don't think it really has evolved, just because they're not blowing each other to pieces, and just because they're not filling the graveyards full of soldiers and policemen. It isn't really, to me, a great sign of progress, except that that's good. But they were always at such a substandard of civilization there, which is a great paradox for me to even say that, since I've written books on the ancient civilization that came out of Ireland, which is, you know, one of the greatest. But of course, we're now talking about, you know, Christian times or whatever you want to call it. The thing was so absolutely in the red to begin with, so violent, so utterly, you know, like I say, racist. You know, from an educational point of view, it was Dickensian, very backward. You know, very elitist as well, of course. You know, the old schoolboy tie and all of that. So yeah, okay. Now that they're not, you know, totally mass murdering each other, it's you know, we should celebrate that. But you know, it doesn't ultimately signal advancement per se, because has the violence really gone away, or has the violence just been transmuted? In other words, are the people psychologically and emotionally evolved? Absolutely not. They're as, you know, materialistic. What's actually happened is that now there's a sort of a flexing of the material muscle, quote unquote. Some prosperity has come in to the country, and with that comes a lot of negatives, like a lot of immigration to a tiny, tiny little island. I mean, again, I emphasize that the whole of Ireland, that's the whole country of Ireland, fits inside Lake Michigan. So, you know, the question arises is whether or not it can sustain, you know, 500,000 or a million Slavs. You know, these are people from Poland and other Slavic countries, you know, who just suddenly appear on the doorstep there and are ingratiated. So it's almost a question of why it was that this trend of immigration happened so quickly on the back of the new prosperity, before the Irish people, who've been saturated in war and violence for centuries, get a chance to enjoy their own country. Now, you know, they're displaced. Jobs are outsourced, and other bodies are present now in the country. Then on top of that, you've got the flexing of the material muscle, technically, because prosperity is there. You're getting a lot of people just, you know, going completely immersed into the material world. You can't blame them, but it's not pleasant to see. And you can see it when you go downtown and you go into the shopping malls and you just see all of this, you know, flagrant sort of materialism. And again, that's not a good thing. You know, at least in the sort of the days of terrorism and oppression, people held to some sort of values. They held to some sort of morality. They held to some sort of camaraderie. You know, there was a certain virtues, in fact, in place, somewhat like the frontier days of America. You know, I mean, you got to look at both sides of it. But there was a code of honor and all of these kinds of things. That seems to be going out the door, you know. So, and then on a higher level, talking from the world controller's point of view, we now have a different kind of terrorism from them. Instead of a militaristic terrorism with guns in the streets and, you know, paramilitary organizations and army and military and police, now you've got economic terrorism. You know, you got the changing of the milieu in Ireland in a much, much deeper way. In fact, I'm glad you brought this up, because just within the last 2 weeks, the world famous poet Seamus Heaney has actually come out and spoken up publicly now, not only against the rape of Tara, which is, you know, the constructions and buildings of roads and toll gates through the ancient site of Tara, but also about what he calls, you know, the spirit of Ireland being lost forever. Absolutely, again, pointing to yet another form of criminality, another form of violence to replace the violence with guns. It's the violence with the dollar. It's the violence with the banks. It's the violence of corporations coming in. And of course, that's true all across the board right now.
Now, in talking about the origins of evil, since you laid out the things that you observed in your own lifetime and which caused you to do research, now, according to your research, what did you discover as far as the origins of evils was concerned? Was it something terrestrial, or was it extraterrestrial as well?
It was primarily extraterrestrial in my reading. And again, my sources for this were the ancient myths. This process goes on. As people who've been checking my forum and checking, you know, the websites, they'll know that the updates are constantly coming in. We've spoken on this on other interviews even, that this is not a static thing. But to answer your question, yeah, absolutely. There seems to be, when you first understand the idea that it's definitely not nature's flaw, it's definitely not some naked parents frolicking in the Garden of Eden who happened to, you know, tick God off one day and then were so severely penalized and all of this kind of thing. It's not evolution where, hey, it's just ignorant man working it out as he goes along, because that also, that evolutionary scheme, does not fit in with what we're learning now about the highly advanced civilizations that predate history. So, I mean, it's not a question of man being primitive working it out. So looking at all of those things, then going to the myths, and they have so much to say about this. You know, the myths are in no doubt about at all, about how this war between the forces of light and darkness was happening on the world, how sorcery and magic were at war, how super technologies was being used, how giants and gods, you know, and all sorts of hybrid creatures was involved in this. But they even go so far as to say, or to imply, that some sort of genetic tampering, some sort of hybridization program was in place. They don't use those terms, of course. And perhaps, yes, say we had had this conversation back in the 1940s or at the turn of the century, before science itself has become more updated, we may have just laughed like so many people have done. We would have laughed at these myths and considered them merely fairy tales or old wives' tales or what have you. But see, we can no longer do that. We're not in at the turn of the century. We're not in the, the twilight of the industrial or agricultural age. We're in the Silicon Age. We're in the, super technotronic age. So when we look back at the myths, how dare we not pay them greater attention, because we now can actually make sense of some of the things that the myths are talking about. So when they're talking about, wounded warriors being restored to a semblance of life, when they're talking about kings with silver arms and body parts, when they're talking about magical weapons that can be let loose on their own without any manual assistance, when they talk about super technologies that are so deadly that entire herds of elephants will be wiped out, that the oceans will boil, that men's hair and fingernails fall out, and all of these anecdotes. And they talk about rockets and Vimanas and all sorts of spacecraft. It's all there. I mean, it sounds crazy, but there it is in the legends. It's we're in the perfect age to be looking back and going, maybe there's something to this. And then if we can accept that, people like myself have taken the next step and said, okay, then what do these myths and legends imply about the psychology of man? They tell us a lot about the technology of man and obsession and the destruction of great civilizations. They talk about, the critical mass being reached in ages past where man's knowledge outweighed his emotional state. And aren't we hastening to that now? Aren't the scientists telling us that by 2012, by 2015 and 2020, the amount of knowledge that we know about ourselves will be just quadrupling? In fact, the gathering knowledge that took maybe a couple of centuries will be doubling every couple of minutes after we've passed the year 2012. In literally a matter of minutes, if not days, we'll be doubling what we know about things, we'll be doubling the amount of information, let's say, in the world, as we used to take centuries to gather. So we're on that, we're in that state again. This is why I'm saying there's so much importance to these ancient myths. So the question then arises, the intelligent person goes, okay, they tell us a lot about these kinds of things, but what do they tell us also about the psychology of man? What do they tell us about his inner being? Is there a point where, the ego stops functioning? Is there a dissolution, not just of mountains and kingdoms and cities and ancient continents, but is there a dissolution psychologically? Is there a timeline to the inner, to the inner consciousness? Does it rise and fall as well? We got tremendous questions there about the dying god and the rebirth of the solar king, and then like the 12 trials of Hercules, etc. And there's so many other fascinating myths about this, about the what they call the senex, as opposed to the young man. Then you have what's called the senex, like we would call senior. Or the elderly one, and it's the parody of the sun. The young sun starts in the morning and then dies in the evening, or the young sun in the spring of the zodiac and then it dies in the winter. So there's a lot of points that have been sort of overlooked. But when you study astrotheology and when you start studying these ancient myths, you start to realize that they also were talking about this dissolution of consciousness. This is also picked up in the Vedas, in which they talk about the great ages or the great aeons, which they call days and nights in the life of God, or days and nights in the life of Brahma. And until it all looks like a just meaningless paganism, until you actually look with the eyes of a scientist and you look at with the eyes of intelligence to understand that these people understood about atomic theory, they understood about the birth and death of suns and galactic galaxies and so forth and so on. There's a tremendous reservoir of knowledge that have been lost. And again, coming back to the main point, is that they say, they're talking about that there were off-world creatures, off-world visitations here. Some sort of tampering process program took place, and that evil is the result of those experiments. And it may not even be that the people who did it were evil. It may be just the mix match of their DNA, their chromosomes, you see, and which is ultimately their consciousness, is it not? With our consciousness, just the coming together of those two foreign elements may have created such a schism, such a trauma, added to by the trauma of the cataclysms externally that were taking place. You have two or three different waves of trauma, both psychological and physiological, taking place almost at the same time. So when I come to the work of, you know, people who study the fossil record and people who are studying the Sphinx in Egypt and people who kind of are getting a handle on the fact that there were massive cataclysms, or when I come to this, you know, the studies of people who are looking at the birth of the ego and the psychology of man, I bring this particular thesis to both those schools of thought, which is, why do you never address the fact of the trauma that took place? You see the evidence in front of your eyes. You see the cataclysms. You see the death rate of the flora and fauna, which is about 13,500 years ago, and then in previous ages also. You have these problems psychologically about man being such a violent, immature, almost hell-bent for leather, you know, creature who's hastening, hurtling towards an Armageddon, a frightening Armageddon of his own making. You have all of this stuff. And you're not understanding that the common root, there's a common root here, is the unbelievable trauma. So when I talk about the genetic manipulation, I'm also really thinking about the trauma that it caused. It wasn't just a simple experiment, you know, of welcome the patient in, lie down, you know, commit the experiment, and then goodbye. Whatever happened there, I believe, was traumatic in the true sense of the word. The ordinary trauma that a human being experiences, say when they've experienced a bomb explosion or a deep, you know, emotional schism or trauma in their life, magnified Gary to the level of the whole of the people, a collective trauma, collectively experienced. Plates down through the different generations and becomes what psychologists call psychological phobias and fears and paranoias. Fear of the ocean. Fear of noise in the sky, fear of darkness, fear of certain hollow, deep places, fear of certain animals or insects, you see, fear of foreigners, fear of strangers. Psychologists will always point to these as being psychological, and of course they are now psychological. But what happens if some of those traumas and phobias actually began on this earth as physiological? Their first, because why otherwise would people who've been on this planet ostensibly millions of years have a fear of water? It's just ludicrous to assume that men who've been on the planet Earth and know everything about the Earth and it's in their genetic record would be so traumatized by, you know, clearly very ordinary things like thunder and even certain kinds of animals and insects, certain kinds of noises. Fear of the dark, for instance. Fear of the dark cannot be explained, you see, in a normal, what they would call phylogenetic way. It has to have come from some sort of trauma that made human beings afraid of the dark. This is what we have to look at. This is what I go into in the Atlantis book.
Folks, you're listening to the Investigators Report. I'm Gary Purifoy with our very special guest, Mr. Michael Tesserion. We have begun our show discussing the origins of evil. Now, with all that we have put out there now, one question which I, you know, have never really asked on this show, but I'm certainly going to take liberty with you because I'm quite sure that you have a wealth of information, you know, because I'm at the point where I have come to understand universal evil, that it exists, and that it does have its roots in the ancient world, and that it is extraterrestrial in many respects. With that said, what about the whole idea and notion of Satan? I mean, and the devil, is that a creation of man, or does an actual ultimate figure of evil such as a devil or Satan really, really exist?
Well, Satan by that name was not, of course, mentioned in the Bible. It was later commenters and clerics who connected the serpentine being in the Garden of Eden with Satan. The Bible itself does not connect them at all. This was later propaganda. This was later interpretive, you know, stuff. And, of course, the great effort to also even identify Eve with Satan or with the fall also was a concoction. Of course, the legend of the Garden of Eden story comes from much more ancient cultures like Sumeria, Babylon, and Egypt, and even in India it's been discovered. And I even think that there's a, you know, some sort of Irish connection there as well. So it wasn't really about evil in the way that we perceive it now. So you're right. Most of this understanding of Satan is utterly modern. For instance, even if you had said Satan in the Christian times, like say the first 440 or 500 years AD, any time in that period, you would have been understood as an adversary. That means in argument. That means if you were a member of a church, or you're a member of an Essene order, or you're a member of a Gnostic order, and you were labeled a Satan, it was never considered negative. It was just considered that you're taking an opposing view. It just meant that you were the opposer of a particular view that the majority is trying to put in place. That's all it meant. The one who will not go along with everyone else. And remember, the reason why one of the priests or one of the members of the congregation might not want to go along with the rest could be for a very good reason. So it didn't necessarily mean that the word Satan meant something negative. It just meant he who contends, or he who, you see, you know, refutes. Taken up to the astrological level, where the Bible has enigmatic passages like, "Get thee behind me, Satan." You know, I'm not even sure if that's the correct translation, but given that it is in the Bible, where did that come from? That's an old astrotheological motif of the sun king or the sun priest in the solar cults rebuking the planet Mars that has always been associated with traits that now Christians will associate with Satan. So in other words, all the traits that Christians and Jews would associate with the evil one, aggression, tyranny, treachery, etc., those were traits that were associated in astrotheological canon of theology with the planet Mars. And the fact that he was young and aggressive and sort of combative. So what the ancients noticed is that the planet Mars would often rise on the horizon before the sun. And then when the sun was rising, it looked like the planet Mars was rivaling the light of the sun, or it wouldn't go away, it wouldn't diminish. So the old pontiffs of the solar cult used to use that expression of "get thee down" or "get thee behind me, Satan," speaking for the sun, saying, "Get thee behind me, Mars," you know. So when Christ is addressing Peter, that's a rescripting of this old method where the enlightened one will not allow his station to be overtaken by an imposter who's a big head in the intellectual realm but has no spiritual wisdom, you see. This is what was understood. And many priests would have used this phrase until it finally found its way into the Bible, where, "Don't rival me, don't play adversary to me in our community, because you're doing as Mars has done to this, our Lord the Sun, the light of the world. Don't try that on me. Get thee down or get thee behind me." This is where this all comes from. But when you talk about the metaphysical aspects of then the satanic concept, and one other anecdote about the whole message of Satan is also from the destruction of a planet in our solar system. I talk about this in the book, and it ties in with the alien visitation theme that, at the same time or close to the time as the aliens visited our planet, they also precipitated the destruction of a second sun, which has gone by many names. One of the names was Lucifer, the light of the morning. That term, light, the sun of the morning or the light of the morning, has been used by different cults for different planetary orbs. It's been used as a name of the sun. It's been used to describe Venus. But I also believe it was probably used to describe this second sun that used to be in our solar system that got destroyed. And the cataclysm of the destruction of that event and the burning, fiery pieces of Tiamat, or this ancient planet that fell, gave rise to the whole idea of the falling Lucifer, or the god that fell out of heaven, you see. But he was a god of light originally, and he fell into the earth. And the ancient records claim that when the pieces of this planet actually did fall, when the last of the remnants of the planet fell, they fell in the sign of Scorpio, or they fell in the part of the sky that ancients recognized as the constellations of Scorpio. So that is why, from that point on, the sign of Scorpio has been given many negative traits. And in fact, in early astrology, not today's astrology, but early astrology, the planet Mars was given over as the ruler of Scorpio. And now we can understand why from what I'm saying. that the sign of Scorpio, the sign of Mars, was always considered, quote-unquote, satanic, Luciferian evil. But it had to do with physical things that happened on our planet. But then moving on, if you go to the metaphysical aspect of what it is, it's very important that we understand that Christianity is a dualistic, that most religions of the world are dualistic. Nothing works within their dogma. Their God, which is nothing more than a projection of the superego, which is nothing more than a projection of man's own egotism, the All-Father. That All-Father, that great champion, that great heroic figure, loses a great deal of his oomph, a great deal of his sort of Arnold Schwarzenegger traits. If there's not a counterbalancing, dark, shadowy, evil sort of being to counterpoint. The knight in search of the damsel in distress looks all the more wonderful if his adversary is that much more dark and evil, and callous and cruel. So this is a drama that has been played out in front of us, and you need two characters. For every Dr. Van Helsing, you need a Dracula, right? For every Robin Hood, you need a Sheriff of Nottingham, For every Sherlock Holmes, you must have a Professor Moriarty. Hey, it works, For every King Arthur, you have a Mordred. It works in drama, and that's what has been put before us on the stage of most religions, is a form of drama. So it wasn't good enough just to have a Solomon and a David and a Hercules, not a Hercules, but a Samson I'm thinking of, or a Jacob or a Joseph or, even a Jesus. Yeah, that's great. You have these magnificent, holier than thou and all capacious characters, but they look even better if you have a dark, evil tempter. And it makes great drama. I mean, that whole thing about, Satan tempting Jesus, saying, I'll give you all the world if you, bow down and worship me. I mean, how can Satan be tempting Jesus? Isn't he meant to be the Son of God that owns everything and can destroy Satan? Why on earth is Satan offering him anything when Jesus is meant to be the Son of God who already has it all? So it doesn't make sense until you realize it's drama. The same thing, Moses coming down from the mountain looks mighty good, looks way better when Balaam is, having his orgies and turning the people away from the mountain and away from God. That makes, this whole drama of Moses coming down and breaking the tablets, and remonstrating with his people and pulling him into line, he looks even greater as a figure, more patriarchal, more patristic. And that's what these religions are hell-bent doing, is creating these very large, larger-than-life, masculine, patristic figures. And the reason to do this had a lot to do with women. It had a lot to do with keeping the feminine, the female, in marginalized roles. And it also had to do with keeping the feminine principle marginalized. It also had to do with divorcing man from nature. And the divorce, of course, didn't work. You can't completely divorce man from these organic things without a pathology taking place. So then that was why about 400 years or whatever after the birth of Christianity, they then conceded to bring in, and I can't remember exactly what council it was that they decided to do this, but they brought in officially then the Virgin Mary. But she had to be virgin, and she had to be pure, and she had to be totally God-infused, So, and they did that because the removal of the feminine will ultimately create psychopathy. And so Christianity realized you have to bring it in, but let's bring it in a very sanitized mold. And so the cult of the Virgin Mary was created from that point on in order to appease man's need, for the feminine principle.
That is amazing. And I'm really glad that you pointed out and very accurately the combination, or at least the fusion, of patriotism with the formulation of religions and what it creates. Now, with you mentioned Tiamat, some of the solar system and things that have happened in the universe prior to elements, or at least events here on Earth. With that, it's also been stated, by several researchers, including Zachariah Sinchin and many others, that involved in that situation as a result of that cataclysm caused the colonization of this planet by races such as the Anunnaku. Then you have other researchers who make mention of the Dracos, or a reptilian-like race that came from the Draco star system. Do they have a place? I'm quite sure they do, and I'm pretty sure you touched on it, in terms of the origins of evil. And how, with that, does the Hollow Earth, because it seems that one of those races took refuge in underground in the Earth, and that's where the whole idea of the Hollow Earth comes from. According to your research, is that what you've discovered as far as that was concerned?
Pretty much, yeah. Pretty much right on there. I don't agree. Of course, when I started researching and writing the book, you do come up against all these other theories, and you know, you have certain areas of agreement and you have certain areas of disagreement. I tend not to really focus on those. That's for the reader to really, you know, work on, is to look at what we've written and come to their own conclusions rather than the authors themselves argle-bargle back and forth about who's right and all that nonsense. That just gets into a lot of ego stuff, you know, and it's so unimportant, really. Because, again, we're all studying different traditions. You know, Zachariah studies the Sumerian-Babylonian record, you know, and Van Dyneken has studied, you know, a lot of the South American record and Americas. And I've focused almost entirely, you know, on the Irish record. So, you know, of course there's going to be discrepancies. We needn't look, we needn't invalidate the entire theory, you see, by these discrepancies, because that's all they are. They're discrepancies in research. We're not living in the past. We don't have the video cameras. We don't have CNN, you know, back there taking film of what happened. So we're like forensic detectives in a way, sort of piecing the great, you know, piece together. And for a long time, a person might think this is the piece that fits here, you know, and 10 years go by and then they realize, you know, okay, no, the piece has to be moved. And, you know, so I will never say that I'm right. I've just offered a bunch of theories that have come out of my particular research. And it seemed to have just, what has happened is, remember, because I didn't do this for any sort of fame or fortune or anything like that. I just wrote this book and it took a life of its own. And what happened is a lot of people responded saying this corroborates and reinforces and also even adds to their own research. I got accolades from people who've been doing this long before I even started. But they liked what I had written. They said this answers a lot of different pieces for us. And that's how my particular, you know, sort of a career in this area sort of got taken off, you know. But before the book went out, I had no idea in the wide world what was going to be made of it. But absolutely, in my theory, there is a hollow earth connection. There is these cataclysms in our solar system that took place. The first visitors, I believe they were not many. And I do believe they are absolutely the same as the Sumerian records speak of the Anunnaki or the Nephilim. Irish records have names for them. One of the names is a Fomori, you know, the giant hybrid beings, or just simply the Atlanteans, simply the you know, the ancient ones, the giants of old, etc. And it's incredible when you read Irish mythology because it's so full of descriptions of these beings. Some of the greatest descriptions of these beings can be found in Irish records, and some of the descriptions of them are pretty hideous. And strangely, and also some of them are very beautiful. In fact, one of the ancient Irish legends talks about the king of the evil ones being the most beautiful man on earth. And in fact, his son was also the most beautiful man on earth. And this ties in very beautifully with the Christian idea. They picked it up later, where Satan was meant to be, you know, the most beautiful amongst all the angels. Where did that anecdote come from? People hear that in the churches and they hear it in the Bible and never think, oh, wait a minute, what happened there? Somebody said that there's this being called Satan, we accept that, but there's an anecdote. There's a description of Satan saying that he is one of the most comely and lovely and beautiful, beauteous of the angels. Why has nobody in the Christian world said, I want to know where that came from? Who wrote it down and where did it come from? Well, I'm here to tell you it came from Irish, ancient Irish mythology. 4,000 to 5,000 years before the Christianity ever arose, there was the king of evil, you know, whose name was Elathan, by the way, Elathan. And Elathan's son was called Bray, B-R-E-A-S. And for many, many generations down, when in Ireland you saw a beautiful child, you would call him a Bray, as a sort of a nickname. He's so Bray, he's a Bray, he's beautiful. Meaning he was beautiful like Bray, the great king of our forefathers. But they were on the dark side. And not only within the dark side, but the rest of their champions were hybrids. These are beings who had, you know, definitely experienced some sort of hybridization. Because they were part animal, you know, part human. This is picked up in Greek mythology and in other mythologies where you have the Minotaur and the Centaur and the Unicorn and the Siren. The Siren is half bird, half woman. I mean, what on earth? Of course you're going to laugh this off until we've come to the 20th and 21st century where, my goodness, the tinkering around with DNA right now, listen, it's not as far-fetched. Can we accept then that in pre-Diluvian times they knew about this, they knew about the genome? The genome project is not something brand new. And getting back to your point, the hollow earth connection is that, yes, because of the incredible upheavals that happened in our solar system, when the visitors came here, they couldn't proceed as they wanted to right away. They took refuge quite quickly, I believe, in caves that were here already on the Earth. Of course, the Earth now looks very different than it did then. So there's probably more entrances, I believe there's more entrances in those days. But they also, like van Dineken has shown, carved their own refuges. I mean, these people can go and visit this kind of thing. Hollow Earth areas, just in the same way like a nuclear fallout shelter, you see, they took refuge for probably a very long period of time. According to the Hopi and Zuni legends of North America, they spent literally generations down under the earth, literally surviving under the earth for generations. Legends say different things, but a fascinating story there. Not only of the fact of the visitation, but then the setting up of the headquarters at Atlantis, which I believe was created by these visitors, and that whole colonization, the first meeting that they would have done with the indigenous population is a whole story in itself. The scanning of their biology, you see, is interesting. The servitude, the desire to have servants, to make servants out of the people that they found here, which is already a violation of Earth sovereignty. And then the greater form of violation, which is right into the biology, right into the cellular makeup of the human being. The most colossal rape, the most colossal violation. And of course, that feeds back into descriptions of the Nephilim. That, yeah, according to the descriptions, this is what these beings that go by the name Nephilim, were capable of. This is why they have been in our records as evil. Now, of course, there's an anecdote saying that the word Nephilim should not be applied to these people, because if these kinds of giants of old existed, there might be a mistranslation, because the word Nephilim has other meanings as well. And, of course, we have to take that on board. But, again, it's not a matter of names. It's not a matter of names. Even if it's found out tomorrow that the word Anunnaki doesn't apply to these beings or had another meaning, or the word Nephilim, should have been applied to the kings of Egypt or whatever, there's all sorts of sub-theories. It still doesn't invalidate the fact of alien visitation. What the ancient scribes are calling these people, or what later mythmongers, tried to label them with, is really a secondary question as to whether they existed or not. It's like future people looking back to us and trying to find names, you see, for the kings and queens of the world or the presidents, and maybe coming up with some pretty names that we would laugh at or say, no, those names didn't belong. But it doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is these people did exist, regardless of the labels and names that are later given to them, you see.
Folks, you're listening to the Investigator's Report. I'm Gary Purifoy with our very special guest, Mr. Michael Tesserion. We've already discussed the origins of evil. We've been discussing the Hollow Earth. But another question that I have as we approach now to talk about 2012, are there still places, because there have been stated by several other ufologists and people who follow government conspiracies, are there entrance points to some of these facilities in the Hollow Earth? And with that said, is the Hollow Earth relative to some of the claimed UFO bases that are supposed to exist underground?
Well, there's no doubt regarding the latter part of your question that that's true. There's a very, very good authors, a fellow called Souder. His first name escapes me, but people go to my Taroscopes links page. They can check it out. A guy who wrote a book called Underground Tunnels and Bases. His second book was about the military angle of all of that. This has been blown wide open. It's been whistleblowed from people within. Absolutely, the man-made militaristic, underground caverns is a huge problem, a huge phenomena that has been thoroughly explained, and as I say, there's a section on it on my links page and the Taroscopes website. But because you have to distinguish between, you see, the Hollow Earth of the past that turns up in mythologies, and then a more modern type of spin on it. Like I think now in, what is it, Japan or somewhere like that, they even have built underground shopping malls and what have you. So there's a whole culture coming of underground sort of locations in the modern world, space saving and all that kind of thing. So it's definitely a phenomenon that exists in today's world. And the military, can no longer deny it. I mean, you only have to look at their patents, certain patents for drills. In fact, this book that I'm referring to, Underground Tunnels and Bases, does go into that. It has pages and pages showing you the military patents for drilling devices that can only be used under the earth and so on and so forth. So then we have the other understanding of the phenomena, which is this more ancient references that come out of mythology. that also we've heard about, you know, the trolls, and we've heard about the dwarves, and we've heard about the king under the mountain in Scandinavian mythology. We have the culture of the elves, and we have the culture of the fairy people, which you cannot talk about the elves or the fairy people in an Irish or Welsh context without talking about the Hollowerth. The two things go together. Whether you're talking about Oberon, the king of the fairies, you see, or the Tylwyth Teg of the Welsh fairies, or the mythologies of the Irish, Dŷ Danann, and so forth and so on, you're talking absolutely about Hollowerth domiciles in which these people live. So there's a very fascinating story there about that. I believe that there may even have been more, as I said, entrances. And I speculate that if they had maps, you know, it would be the ancient maps that would show you most of these locations. What makes my work in the Hollow Earth area more sort of controversial is that I, when I was out in the field taking measurements and trying to study this absolutely in the field, taking compasses and protractors and, you know, all of that kind of thing, I'm not very good at mathematics or any of that stuff, so... You know, I took a person who knew a lot about cartography, or at least was very good with the calculators and compasses and all that. This person came along sort of like my left brain, so that my right brain could, you know, function sort of unmolested. But when we went out into the field and to start studying the ancient Irish megalithic sites, and also this concept of the Hollow Earth, did it or did it not exist, we found out that it did exist, but it was an interesting tie-in to the present or the positioning of churches. Because people will turn around and say to you, oh my goodness, Michael, you know, if these places existed like you said, then we'd be able to find them, you know, they'd be there. Why aren't they there anymore? And it just turns out that they're not there because later cults who wanted to obscure this, I believe, positioned their churches, their chapels, and their stately homes over the entrances of the Hollow Earth that were known in ancient times. And now these people that I'm talking about are the descendants of the same people who killed off all the druids and killed off the bards and who burned and expurged and also plagiarized, but basically sequestered all of this knowledge. So the knowledge that I'm talking about is only going to be still found in Masonic lodges, you see, in very elite Masonic lodges or in elite type libraries that people like Professor Tolkien and others would have had access to. And you'll find certain anecdotes about it in the myths and legends, as I've said, remnants, relics, vestiges of this of these teachings. And it's not very possible to go and prove what I'm talking about, sadly. So it only remains in the realm of speculation. For me, it's more than that because I've been out there. And I have a serious belief that a lot of buildings, even government buildings, Masonic halls, for instance, and the study of the floors of these buildings, that what I mean by that is the murals. This is the artistic aspect. What the checkered floor represents, for instance, some of the stars and geometries that are found on the floors and the murals and many other sorts of strange symbolism. The symbolism in certain stained glass windows, the certain symbolism has been incorporated into churches and into cathedrals. The names of the locations. And of course, you know, I'm going right back to when I was 13 when I first started this. I'm thinking of the amazing things that I discovered there. Certain, even the growth of certain trees. There's a phenomenon known in geomancy as the spiral tree, that certain trees, the bark grows in a very particularly spiralic direction. This signifies that there's water running underneath. It also tells you what kind of water is running underneath. It also tells you whether or not there's, you know, caverns beneath the area that you're talking about. So I have a strong belief that these places still exist, but they've been covered over. They've been purposely covered over, and that only the elites, the very elite noble families, you see, whose families have grown up in these stately homes, they are the people who had the secret of it. And this is a secret that's been kept from the world's masses.
Very interesting. And now that brings us now, as we are coming up on our final quarter of the hour, in the last 15 minutes of the program, where we can discuss 2012. Because I agree with you. I mean, there's certainly a lot of geomancy in our corporate logos. We see it even in some of the products and symbols that are advertised, whether it be on TV or in print. A lot of geomancy, and particularly down in Washington and in many of the structures and a lot of our construction and infrastructure in many cities. I mean, just take a look at Austin, Texas. That's a perfect example, even down to several buildings, which even take on the feature characteristics of an owl. So, yes, I agree with you. But with that said, and I'm glad you mentioned the elite families, because I'm pretty sure that they they play a role as it pertains to the future of mankind in 2012. Let's talk about that. I mean, there are several questions I will have even as it pertains to our current presidential races, but let's talk about 2012 and where we're headed and all the components that are involved and where the future of mankind really lies.
Well, thanks for that. That's very accurate. And in fact, again, because it's such a tremendously controversial subject, let me mention two books that are written by, you know, scientist types. So if people want to go and research this, they can either pick up my book on Atlantis, which has phenomenal information on this, or they can just go straight to two more academic-style books about this concept of the geomancy. And one is called The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital by David Ovison. Ovison. It's on Amazon. And David Ovison's The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And the second book is simply entitled Talisman, and it's by Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall. Again, I really hope that people will pick those up. The only caveat that I will say is that in both cases, the authors haven't the faintest idea why these things are happening. They beautifully and meticulously record and, you know, explain tremendously in a scientific, technical way, you know, in a geometrist architecture, architectural way that people can understand, even about the heavens. They explain what's happening beautifully, you know, tremendous works they are, but they are not able to explain exactly why this kind of astromancy, this kind of geomancy, this kind of basically these ancient pagan traditions are being used. And, you know, maybe it's because they still don't themselves have a handle on the fact that, you know, where secret societies are running the shop, from the shop to the top. Maybe they're not, you know, yet conversant with the fact that there's groups called the Skull and Bones. There's groups called, you know, the Bohemian Society, you know, who worship the owl and whose tutelary symbols are to be found in the landscape and in the civic centers and all of this kind of thing. They're maybe not aware of the whole Gaelic, Irish, Druidic tradition that so much has been plagiarized by Judeo-Christianity and so on. So just bear that in mind, but those two books really stand out. Getting to the question of 2012, well, right now we're filming our DVD that's coming out. The title is actually The Future of Mankind, Mass Control and the Future of Mankind, and it's the first one of a series of new DVDs. People can check it out. By the way, we have a trailer up on the Architects of Control website. So if they go to architectsofcontrol.com, they'll see our little trailer of this new DVD that is looking very deeply into this question of 2012. The DVD, the first DVD in this series that's coming out in late April, is actually, you see, a carry-on of a talk that I did in Los Angeles, which was called 2012, The Future of Mankind. And I had so many comments about that. There's over 800,000 people have watched this on Google. And we've just been inundated with a lot of, you know, questions. I mean, I thought I'd covered everything, but of course, we're always wrong when we think that. And people saying, I want more on this. What are you talking about? You know, this aspect, or explain that more. And it just became so big. And we take notes of what people ask us. And so it seemed that, look, you know, I was telling my colleagues, we're going to have to do a continuation of this little freebie talk that I did, because there's just too many people asking questions. And as we try to script it, we start to realize that, you know, instead of moving towards a utopia, 2012, which of course what all the New Age people have been saying for over 30 years, waving their tinsel and, you know, dancing around, just can't wait for the age of Aquarius, etc. And I've always looked at that as a cop-out, because I know many people who are prominent in the New Age movement. I've been very much exposed to all of that, and it never seemed to ring true to me at all. You know, it didn't ring true to me. In fact, the Bible actually made more sense, because the Bible was talking about a period of tribulation, a period of rapture, a period of difficulty, a time of apocalypse in which, you know, the sheep and the goats are basically going to be separated, you know. And I kind of was more looking at that and thinking, you know, this makes more sense to me, that you don't just have a nice, you know, sort of merry, you know, dance or party up to the New Age, whatever, you know, these toxic people, immoral people, people who've done enormous criminality in their life, morally and so on. You know, what about them? You know, what about the leaders? What about the people we're controlled by? What about the way, you know, just so many factors? What about a lot of things we're doing suddenly just some other spiritual entity comes in or a big bolt of light, and then we're all, you know, transfigured. I mean, it doesn't make sense. There must be a period of tribulation of some kind before that. And that's what a lot of the ancient legends are saying. When you go back into the Native American culture or the Druidic culture, and you even look in the Bible, you know, the relevant parts, basically prophecies, the whole cult of prophecy does talk about an ending of the old age before you get into the new age. And so when you take on board the astro-theological component of this and really study what age we're in, which is the age of Pisces, and we understand that there's also a lot of Saturnian elements to this, that we've also, in many ways, we can be described as a Saturnian age, just from the point of view of the powers that be. And you see that, look, these edifices are not going to change easily. The way, you know, the status quo is not going to just change easily. There's going to be some sort of, you know, upheaval. And it's looking at that and also looking at the state that man is in. Where is man heading? You know, is he heading for a dystopia as opposed to a utopia? Is he so artificializing his own environment that he may himself become a plastic entity within a plastic world, so to speak? Meaning, if everything he creates is so anti-natural, if everything he creates is so synthetic, if everything he lives in, you know, the false light, I mean, the whole concept of the fluorescent light and the food and all the rest of it, is man in danger of losing his own humanity? And I look around in the world and go, yeah, absolutely, it's already happening. It's already been happening since probably the Industrial Revolution, and it's certainly speeded up since the World Wars. And the process has continued and continued and continued, and certainly in an American context, because, of course, America's had more of everything, more leisure time, more capital, and so forth. So it's a little bit faster in the American context. But let's not just imagine that this is a problem of only America, you see. This is a problem of the entire Western world that has lost its roots. You know, that would fall down on its face tomorrow if suddenly the machines basically stopped. You know, where'd you get your air conditioning from? You know, how would we get our bananas? You know, how would we get our vitamins pills? You know, how would we make baskets and shirts? You know, how would we even make a chair or a table? You know what I mean? And all the other infinite things, you see. I'm not a doom predictor, but I'm just saying, let's look at the realities here. But then there's this whole psychological component. And that's what the DVD, that's what my theories are really about now when we look to 2012, is again focusing on consciousness. Where is man in his consciousness? And I don't believe he's in a very good place. I believe that man is very arrested from an emotional, psychological point of view. I think that the evidence for that is obvious and all pervasive, that the enlightened people and the awakened people, the people who are willing to sacrifice and give up, you know, the safety net or the safety zone in order to pursue truth, you know, are incredibly the few. And we're surrounded by basically robotic automaton, you know, people who are just happy to go along to get along. So when I look at this, and I also look at the rising levels of medication, both legal and illegal, and I'm also thinking of the illegal drug use, the methamphetamine, all of this kind of culture. When I'm looking at the television culture and the media culture, you see, and I'm looking at the general ambiance of panic and paranoia. Let's not talk about whether or not that's justified or not. I'm just talking about the fact that it exists. What happens tomorrow if this all turns out to be just part of the sorcery of the George Bushes and the people of the world? It's not that they're not capable of going and bombing and murdering and killing, and of course that continues, doesn't it? But there's an offshoot of all of that. In constant wars and rumors of wars and constant threats, there's a culture of paranoia and fear and anxiety that is being created that I believe is worth gold or platinum to the leaders. And so they don't mind, in fact, throwing up a big shadow of a new Goliath in order to scare people psychologically, and even bandying certain talismanic terms around like terror. There's a lot of weight in that word. There's a lot of double meanings and a lot of connotations to the term. I've gone into this in the DVDs. And a lot of the symbolism that's used, where they always show the president, you saw maybe with stars or a light above his head or the halo, you see, or in some other way framed like a sort of Christ-like being. To me, it's just utter blasphemy to be even identifying these evildoers with any child of light. But this is what the media is doing. And there's a lot of this culture in our life. And then you predict it. You just take this phenomenon, you start projecting it into the future, and you start seeing that the technocratic age is on its way. The cyber age is really on its way. The world of virtual reality is on its way. And the world of the post-human creature, post-human man, is on his way. Partly it is instigated and funded and initiated by the world crime families, the brokers of the world. But that's not the only part of the equation. My focus is more on that man himself is going to walk in line towards a lot of this culture. He's going to want a lot of this because the promise is that it's going to alleviate you from your emotional problems and from a lot of the downsides of the weight of existence. Because as I said before, I don't think man is capable of facing reality as it is. You know, I'm a Freudian and I believe that man has always had a great difficulty with the reality principle and that he'd much rather be in what Freud referred to as the pleasure principle, which is okay for a child between the ages of, say, 1 and 5 or 1 and 7, you know, et cetera, to be sort of in the bubble of the, you know, the pleasure principle. But it's not right for, you know, an adult to be permanently in that place. And I'm thinking that a lot of people in the world today are regressing. They're not capable of dealing with the reality as is, partly for the reasons we mentioned with the media. And that this is all leading somewhere, you see. You got to project it out to the future. You got to think, okay, what is the tendency? Where are we going with all of this? And I believe we are heading towards a post-human world. And I do believe that one of the target dates is 2012. That if we're not already there by 2012, 2012 will be the beginning of the post-human world. Basically, it will either the physical, the scientific discoveries that are made then will revolutionize what we know about technology. The rate of information and data accumulation, which I've already mentioned, will be so accelerated at that point that that will constitute a great change. And many other factors involved as well. The beginning of the organic computer, for instance. I mean, we are pretty much every month, every quarter, every 6 months making leaps in this kind of cyber technology. And as you said, look at the media, look at the advertising, look at the ad copy. So many cyborgs. So many images of, you know, robots and mechanical men and women making it almost, hey, you want to be like that. Hey, that's going to be cool. You have all these powers. You have all this psychic ability. You are able to, you know, explore so many virtual realities. Just like, you know, in sci-fi, you know, you see people putting on headsets, going into virtual landscapes. Digital landscapes in which they can be any number of personas. They can have any number of, you know, adventures, you see. That's fascinating. It's okay for a video game, but is that what we're heading towards? Are we heading towards a technotopia? This is what my work is now.
That's very interesting. And now that's pretty much covered our hour. I mean, we are pretty much almost out of time. But, you know, it's very, very interesting to take a look at because unfortunately we don't have time to go into it, but maybe we could pick this up in another discussion in regards to how this upcoming 2008 presidential election will figure into things. Now, in regards to give the listeners your website information and how they can find you on the web before we go, Michael.
Thanks, Gary. Sure, people can always go to michaeltosarian.com to get to all the different websites. They'll see the Architects of Control website can be accessed from that one. And also my latest book, The Irish Origins of Civilization, and all the other products and, you know, pages that we have. They can also get to my forum if they want to leave a comment. There's also a lot of great links on the forum that are updated almost every 24 hours, news reports, but also other very interesting links. Two sources of what we're talking about, both technological and other. So they need to, you know, check out the forum and at least come in there at least once or twice a week to see what we're doing on the forum there. So just go to michaeltosarian.com and, you know, you'll see all these links.
Michael, we thank you again for being with us. And ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to thank you for being with us during this session of the Investigators Report. And we urge you to join us for our next show. But until that time, may the God of the universe bless you. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to The Investigators Report, which is a regular feature of this station and is produced by Garinger Research and Investigations. For more information on this program and for upcoming programs, and to even listen to past programs in our archives, be sure to log on to our blog page at theinvestigatorsreport.blogspot.com. That address again is theinvestigatorsreport.blogspot.com. Well, we trust you enjoyed this informative and provocative program, and we urge you to join us next time for our next session of the Investigators Report right here on the Community Listening Network.